Hi, I'm your host, Andrew Sanders.
And I am your co-host, Flo Labrado.
Welcome to Different at Work, where we talk navigating the modern workplace and cultivating professional relationships while being wired a little differently.
Today's episode is a continuation of last week's episode. We started to talk about what it might be like to navigate the job search process and even whether choosing to disclose one's neurodivergence. It was such a good conversation. We had to make this a two-parter. In last week's episode, we talked about the different friction that someone might encounter, how the typical advice of apply for a lot of jobs and go build relationships in person needs to be handled thoughtfully. And maybe it needs to be different for someone whose brain is not neurotypical, even with getting to the point of applying for jobs and not even getting to the point of interview. And this is important, just a reminder, if you heard the first half of this conversation, that in July, there were nearly 7 million people in the United States who were unemployed and looking for work. And knowing that at least 20% of the people have ADHD or another type of neurodivergence, that we can extrapolate that almost 1.4 million people are looking for work, navigating this job market, and neurodivergent.
And it's a really hard thing to do with a neurodivergence because you think about the people-pleasing tendencies, the rejection sensitivity that's common in people with neurodivergence. I shared my example, like self-promotion is very difficult for me. So you can imagine how bad the job market is or job search process is because that is pretty much entirely self-promotion. It requires a lot of vulnerability. That just puts so much pressure on someone with a neurodivergence to have to follow that process because there is no other way around it. You got to play the game as it is written for everybody.
So let's go with the individual. You've applied for a bunch of jobs. You finally get one that is not a rejection. And you also actually get a response that is not a ghosting. And now it's time for the interview, whether it is a screening with a person in HR or a conversation with the hiring manager or talking with an actual person at this point. We jump through all the hoops and how that might be different for someone with ADHD, autism, dyslexia, or their brain is just different than what this world is expecting.
Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, the interview process can be a little daunting. And especially when it's high stakes and it's a job you really want or a job you really need, I think the process just becomes even more difficult. Like my best interviews that I've done are jobs that I really didn't care that I got them or not, and then I ended up getting offers.
Right? I'm curious, what's different? What's different in that situation when you feel sort of like indifferent about the job? What changes for you?
There's just less pressure, I guess. So perhaps I'm a little more authentic and conversational. I don't know. Because I've shared with you before that I prefer to have asynchronous interactions because it gives me the chance to think before I speak and to edit myself a little bit. But in the job process, you can rehearse. You can hire a coach to help you perfect your elevator speech or refine your strengths and whatnot. But we all know this. When you're actually face-to-face with somebody, it's a little harder. You don't have the notes in front of you necessarily. You're in person. So it's not like you have index cards and you're going through your talking points, right? And if it's something you really care about, the stakes are higher. So the pressure's higher and that can trip you up. So for me, having that difficulty with self-promotion, and why should we hire you? Because that's always a question, right? Why are you the right candidate for the role? Inside voice says, I don't know if I am. I don't see all your resumes.
The point with mentioning literal interpretation of a question and the expected answer, that I can imagine can be tricky, not only with the usual, why are you the right person for this job, or tell me about your history or experience or whatever. But let's talk about those behavioral interview questions.
You know, I am so guilty as a hiring manager of this. So to our listening audience, I apologize, and especially if you have ever gone through one of the interviews that I've conducted, I apologize for the hypocrisy you were about to hear. So an example of a question that I used to love asking people is, if you encountered somebody that's never seen a computer or heard of the internet, how would you explain the internet to somebody? And I used to love asking that question because it required people to think on their feet. And there's no right or wrong answer to it. It's all about your reasoning, your train of thought, and then how you can justify it. So let's dig into this, because I'm definitely guilty of asking some of these bad behavior-based questions.
Me too. There's so much. And I've done this before. I've asked the questions that the spirit of the question might be to help understand how someone might communicate something to different stakeholders and how agile they are with flexing their communication. And I think there's good intention in those kinds of questions. I think whether it's HR, hiring managers get in trouble is that they might not realize that someone whose brain leans towards literal and binary or black or white might answer that question differently. And their answer and your question by default does absolutely nothing to help you learn about the person and their ability to do the job. It doesn't say anything. All it says is that maybe the question's terrible and the answer is as good as it can be given the terrible question. But then there's other questions, and I've done this myself, where asking the, can you tell me about a time when you experienced XYZ and that is it? Someone might take that question and respond literally and tell the hiring manager, the interview panel, the answer to that question. Yet what the interviewer is expecting is something else. They might be expecting that star format, the situation, the task, what action did you take in the results? But that wasn't in the question. And so someone might answer it literally and completely miss the unspoken request for additional detail.
Yeah. Well, and I think the questions that you ask, I think that people lose sight of the fact you're asking people that have not been in the job. They do not have exposure to the job. How do I know this? Because you're interviewing them for the job, right?
They're not there yet.
So, right. So I think you're setting yourself up for a confirmation bias, really. You might select the person that maybe sounds the most like you, but isn't necessarily the best for the job. And I know that selection tests should be accurate, but if you think about the percentage of people that have ADHD specifically or autism, that's a low amount of people. The percentage is so small that those selection tests might still pass and be valid and accurate, but you're still weeding out a whole bunch of people that would be great for your organization.
Exactly. And this brings me to something else that drives me absolutely bonkers. And that is, whether in person or a virtual interview, the expectation that making eye contact is important. And that if someone, the assumption or the assessment made that if someone doesn't make eye contact, they're not interested in this job, they're not paying attention, they're not here, they're not focused on the conversation, which that infuriates me. And I've heard this before. Well, you have to be able to make eye contact in order to be present and blah, blah, blah. Like, what if someone's way of communication, they might be listening keenly, they might be empathetically present with you, but eye contact is just not part of how they communicate. And we might be inadvertently excluding someone in their interview process over something that doesn't matter.
Yeah. And this isn't DEI, by the way. This is just common sense. Like, you're setting yourself up for little mini-me's, right? And you're missing an opportunity to... Okay, maybe it is DEI because we use the word diversify, but you're losing the opportunity to diversify your talent on your team to reflect the people that actually use your products, right? Like, I, as a hiring manager, I much prefer hiring people that will challenge the way that I think, but these questions don't necessarily do any service to find those people.
Agreed. And there are other ways, right? So what if it's not behavioral interviews? What if it's a technical interview? One of my favorite approaches might be to include not only behavioral questions or those types of get to know you questions, but also some sort of hands-on activity to demonstrate someone's competence. It could be a technical interview, or it could be to create a document or presentation or something like that, which can be really neat for someone who maybe in an interview doesn't come across the way that they're expected, but they can demonstrate that can actually do the job, or they have the skills and competencies required in a very different way. How might that open up the world or the access to opportunity for someone who is wired differently?
But Flo, how would we assess them for culture fit on the team?
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry. I'm asking this sarcastically because I feel like this is a miscellaneous or potpourri box that managers use to mentally justify not hiring people they don't want to hire.
Culture fit and executive, what is it? Executive maturity. Those two. And there is a purpose to culture. It is good to consider, is this person going to thrive in the culture? For example, if an organization, let's say they're an organization, maybe a small or medium-sized business, and maybe it's still operated by the founder, and the culture might be very familial, very sort of like a clan type of close-knit culture. It would be smart to bring in someone to the organization who will thrive in that environment. I totally get that. But that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, can I push back even on that?
Because
isn't the responsibility on the job seeker to make that decision about themselves?
Absolutely. They get to choose. This is a two-way process. The job seeker gets to say, hey, do I want to be here? Do I not want to be here? But then on the flip side, let's say, hey, I run a small business. I only have, 50 employees, and I'm the CEO. I'm also the founder, and almost everyone has access to me and access to each other because we're small. And you have someone who comes in, and maybe they like to have a lot of process, a lot of red tape, a lot of structure that doesn't work for my business, right? It may not be a good fit. I have a responsibility to make that choice. That said, when culture fit is basically code for, I just don't like this person, we get in trouble because the behaviors that may be observed on which affinity bias is assessed may be something that is completely irrelevant when assessing someone's ability to do the job well.
Yes. And you can't say it's because you're avoiding conflict, because guess what? Some conflict is healthy.
Yeah. Conflict is good.
So conflict is good.
Conflict is good. That brings up another point. And there's usually some kind of question about relationship building or how to handle conflict or teamwork and whatnot. And those are good questions to have dialogue, to get to know each other better. Then what happens when the person who is responding to the question is expected to magically know what the spirit of the question is, and they don't get it?
Yeah. And again, they haven't been in the job yet, so they don't really know the types of relationships that you or your team are dealing with. So you're kind of setting everybody up to fail. And some of these questions have actually, I've regretted some of my decisions in the past based on some of these questions, because we passed on people that maybe would have been more valuable than some of the people that we hired. And if you've ever reported to me as a direct report, I'm definitely not talking about you.
But then let's talk about the person who is in the hot seat, the person who is being interviewed, the person who is given the mini project to complete to demonstrate competence, or is asked to take some kind of assessment. Looking at it from their perspective, how hard all of this might be, and what are some of the things that might help them? One thing that, and I'll start with this one, because I'm thinking of not just one person, but multiple people that I've worked with for how to be able to, I don't like the word perform, but to thrive in an interview, knowing that RSD is part of their experience, and how to be able to build the resilience that you can access in the moment when maybe a question is asked that is off-putting or triggers that anticipation or perception of imminent rejection.
Or the analysis paralysis, right? Like you are stuck trying to get the perfect answer. So you are too focused on the perfect to even spit out the good, right?
Yeah. And how to move to that. And some of the work that it could be is, and this is hard work. This is not a one and done, but some of the work might be to have strategies to be connected with your body. You know, people jokingly say, go touch some grass or whatever, but it really is about being connected in your physical body to remind yourself the space that you occupy and that you are well. That whether it is, you know, touching your hands or feeling the air or something else that gives your nervous system the input that you are okay, could be the small strategy that reduces the severity of the experience of RSD and allows someone to recover in that situation. That is hard work. That's not a one and done, right? That is hard work. However, there are so many people out there who struggle because they may not even realize that what they're experiencing is common to other people with neurodivergence and that there are strategies that they can leverage in that moment.
You know, that's a really good point. On our website, I wrote a piece about the 2E individual, twice exceptional. And basically what that means is you're dealing with like two different reasons to be exceptional, like different from the general population. So you might be high achieving because you're gifted or intelligent. And then also be, you know, ADHD or neurodivergent, but your gifted abilities have hidden your neurodivergence because you've been able to perform so well that you yourself have not even noticed that you have ADHD. And that really resonates with me. You know, I was on the cusp of the gifted classes. I even had to ride a short bus once to high school because I was in the special class for the smart kids. And I, you know, high achieving, and I didn't realize that I had ADHD or had a problem with how I process the world around me until after I had some life-changing experiences. We'll put it that way, right? We've talked a little bit about my past and it's written about it on the website. And the reason I'm bringing it up now is because I would hate for one of those 2E or high-performing people to realize that they have an issue with neurodivergence during a job search process or during an interview process. That crash, when you're not expecting it, it's a huge shock to your system and it drives like so many negative feelings about yourself. So it's really important to be prepared, I guess, emotionally and spiritually, psychologically, for the rejection in the interview process. So one of the things that I do actually think, one of the standard pieces of advice people give during a job search is to practice, right? Practice your questions, your answers. And I don't think it's the questions and answers that you're practicing that helps you the most. I think it's the rejection. Like, hire somebody, work with a friend that where you can practice, like have them be as non-expressive as possible so you can read into their non-expression. Practice how you read body language, because, you know, a hiring manager's task is to try to appear impartial. So you might get someone that's not smiling, not giving any clues as to how they're thinking about it, and they're a blank face. And you might be reading that as, oh my God, I'm not telling them what they want to hear. I'm bombing this. But that's not the case. They're probably just trying to be impartial, taking notes.
Yeah. To me, that sounds like a moment to practice grounded confidence. And yes, of course, it's important to, you know, read the room the best that you can, but also remaining grounded in what you offer, what you bring to the table, that even when not being able to get a read of the person in front of you, or maybe your neurodivergence makes it difficult to even get a read of the person in front of you, even if they're your best friend, right? To be able to be grounded in who you are, what your strengths are, what you have to offer, your experience, your essentially your brag book of accomplishments that you can not even fall back on, that you can stand on in that moment when things feel a little bit shaky, to remember who you are and the value that you bring. Something else that I want to raise is masking and code switching. This drives me nuts. And let's set the table here. Everyone code switches. If everyone has their, like, you don't communicate the same way when you talk to your parents or you talk to your best friend or you talk to your partner. I communicate very differently when I talk with my mom. That's Big Flo. I love her so much. Versus, you know, when I'm talking with my sisters. Or code switching is a part of our social ability to adapt and flex based on the circumstances. However, it is also a very adaptive mechanism that can be cognitively taxing when trying so hard to mask and to not let on that, hey, maybe my brain is wired differently. The things that might go through someone's mind, do they know? Do they notice a difference? Am I fitting in? Can they tell? How am I coming across? All of that is mental energy that is expended, that is pulled away from other things like listening to the question, formulating an answer, engaging in the back and forth that is required. And that is hard.
Yeah. And I think this goes back to what I said earlier, the interviews where, you know, I wasn't really enthused about the job or whatever, and I just didn't feel like there were high stakes involved were the best because he wasn't focusing on those things, right? Like, you could feel how you want to feel. Like, all right, take this. I don't care. But it kind of took that code switching off the table as kind of an aggregating factor into how I felt about things, right? So maybe my performance was not as impacted by that. That's something to think about.
Yeah, there's less energy involved because maybe the stakes were lower. Now, something that could make it easier, theoretically, is to make the choice to disclose in the interview.
That's a touchy one.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the interview process,
let's open
that can of worms. Go for
it. So a few episodes ago, we talked about disclosing your neurodivergence in the workplace and how much risk is involved in choosing to say to your boss, to your colleagues, like, hey, I'm autistic, I have dyslexia, I have ADHD, whatever it is, right? And we use the definition of trust provided by Charles Feldman, which is that trust is choosing to make something I care about vulnerable to the actions of another person. And as hard as it is in the workplace, at least you know each other. There's a social system that you're a part of. Well, let's rewind. We're now in the interview process, whether it's a screening with the HR person or a panel interview or your final interview with the hiring manager. What about the choice to disclose?
Hey, woof. I'm on the fence on this one, honestly, because there is still a lot of stigma and stereotype out there about neurodivergence. A lot of people just simply don't understand it, right? They don't understand that there is a plus side and all the superpowers that I've called them that come with it. And people are looking for reasons to exclude you. It's not an inclusive process. They're not looking for reasons to bring you into the process. The managers and the companies are looking for reasons to take you out of the pool, right? So does this become a subconscious bias then? And I don't know. I hear what you're saying about how this could make the process better if you are just straight up and say, hey, like, here is how my brain works. And it would really help for me to, you know, do this virtually, or I don't even know what the accommodations would look like because I haven't even ever considered that. But going through the interview process, like, or even the application process, you do have those questions at the end of the application that say, like, check if you have a disability, right? And they don't, a lot of times don't list ADHD on there, but this isn't what Flo's talking about. She's not talking about checking that box. She's talking about
saying it.
And well, a lot of places too will even in their emails follow up with like, if you need special accommodation for anything, here's our HR accommodations team. Let us know. But I've never even considered using that because I've never considered needing an accommodation.
Yeah. There's risk involved. And there are also different roles. For example, the HR recruiter, they are very likely in your corner. They're advocating for you. They're helping you get ready for the interview process because part of their job is to get as many qualified candidates in front of the hiring manager. And so you could say like they're in your corner and it might feel safer there to disclose. However, what if because of their biases, they see that as much as they try to include and say, it doesn't matter, we'll accommodate you. There's that fear of what in the back, in the back of their minds, that changes things. What if gets back to the hiring manager or the three people in the panel who are going to interview me next?
Yeah. Or like, oh, here comes FMLA that's going to need time all the time, or someone that's going to be tardy, or insert whatever stereotype there is about ADHD behavior. In our last conversation about disclosure, we said once you ring that bell, you can't unring it. And so that is the risk. So what's the risk reward analysis here then? So we were saying in the interview process, probably would be better at the start of the interview to, if you're going to disclose to the hiring manager, say something about...
like rip the Band-Aid off.
Okay. So I said I was on the fence and I see both sides. So the other side that I see is that it's healthy for you to be in an environment that is healthy for you. And I know that sounds very obvious, right? But think about it. You are trying really hard to get this job and you're worried about how they would perceive your ADHD. That's a problem because ADHD is not something you could hide in a healthy way. You can overcompensate and you could burn your candles at both ends and be on a train to burnout town, right? So maybe disclosing is beneficial. See, I don't know. My gut
hard,
still tells
right?
me no. My it's gut still hard. Tells me no because they're looking for reasons.
It's hard. And I'm checking my privilege here, right? As someone who, as far as I know, I'm neurotypical. That remains to be seen. But I want to use a different scenario. For a long time, if you don't know me, I am a Black Latina born in the Dominican Republic. I have medium dark skin and curly hair. And I remember for job interviews, being so intentional about code switching, making sure my hair was straight, making sure I didn't wear, if you could see me right now, I have like a 2.5-inch hoops, right? Making sure my hoops were smaller and doing all the things to make myself fit as closely as possible to what is expected, right? In the workplace. That's visual. And I can flex that and then go home, wash my hair and have my curls again. But it is, to me, it is very different when taking the risk to disclose something that is not something that can be outwardly changed. And this reminds me of, there's some really interesting research that came out in the last month or so out of a university in France, the Audencia Business School, that was published in the Academy of Management Journal. It looked at 5 different cases of adults in the workplace with ADHD and other neurodivergences. And the findings are that people benefit from accommodations in the academic system, but once they join the workforce, they experience this abrupt vanishing of support. And that people have a hard time asking for accommodations and even disclosing because they don't see role models in the workplace that that they can look to and say, oh, hey, this person is open about the neurodivergence and maybe I can be open as well. And it results in this sort of disorientation and reluctance to make requests. Well, what happens when you're not even an employee of the organization yet?
This is a larger conversation too, because I think a lot of this is driven by how we treat mental health in this country. And like you said, if it's not an obvious, you know, outwardly facing disability or differently abledness, then people, I don't know, make assumptions about what they think a term means or a behavior is. And you're right. I don't know that there have been any role models that I've seen out there for ADHD. In our company, it's not something people talked about. And another large part of that is in our society, that we don't talk about mental health, but at work, we often don't talk about things that are personal to begin with, right?
We don't. There's this barrier to that, right? And when it comes to neurodivergence too, that requires almost like an intentional disclosure by people who are in positions of power that can show that if they can be autistic or have ADHD or whatever in a position of leadership, that it's okay for other people too. Because you can't look at someone and immediately know how their brain operates. So it does take other people who have more power and less risk to absorb for them to be explicit in their disclosure in order to make it safe for other people, including candidates, to disclose as well. Now, in this conversation, we've talked a lot about the experience of someone as a candidate in the job process. Well, what can we do about it? what can organizations who are looking to fill positions do to be able to not only attract, but seriously consider very well-qualified candidates who are neurodivergent?
That's a great question. I think the first step is to stop expecting perfection from every candidate and be open to people that are different. It's one thing to say that you're supportive of different people, different, you know, neurodivergences or cultures or whatnot, but you got to expose yourself and do a little bit of research too. You got to understand that maybe the way you ask questions is not universal, because you can't really flat out ask somebody if they're neurodivergent.
Then that can be modeled.
Let's game that out. Modeled how, and how would you safely model that?
Let's talk about within the organization. If someone, I mean, your business is your business, right? But if someone is a position of power and they talk about inclusion, or, you know, we want people who think differently so we can do our best work, disclose when you think differently. Disclose that your autism, ADHD, whatever it is, make it safe for other people to do that. And if that begins to change the culture of the organization where people truly feel seen and valued and accepted, then that would also be reflected, not just on the website and whatever values are talked about and exposed to the public, but also it is felt in every part of the culture, including in the recruiting, interview, hiring, and really the entire talent management process.
Yeah, that is a corporate utopia that I hope to work for one day, because it's not just having values as a lip service, right? You're not just, you know, paying consultants to come up with six bullet points for you to talk about and say how great you feel about people, but actually having role models, you know, in the organization. And if I ever get back into the corporate role, I'll probably try to be a people leader again, because I just loved being able to work with and see people develop in their careers and playing a role in that. But I would definitely take with me an openness about my disclosure, or I would definitely disclose at work. I'm a firm believer that that would not only make it a safer space for me, but it would also help me work more effectively with my teams by kind of setting the scenario of why I think differently, how I think differently, and, you know, the written notes that I need or the time considerations that I need. I'm not ever going back in the box and trying to put that round peg in that square hole again.
Yeah, that's exhausting to live that way.
Yeah. So I think the challenge for anybody listening to this is maybe you might not be the leader that sets the culture now, but if you're on that career trajectory, I hope that one day everybody gets to be a CEO or a VP. But my challenge to you is set that culture, set that tone, set that openness for other people. And it will, like Flo said, it will roll down to even the candidate selection process at some point. Now, putting on my MBA hat for a second there, you've got to be careful with how that's done, because you also don't want to open yourself up to any sort of legal litigation. So you have to make sure that your interview questions, your selection process is all above board. So don't go asking people what their mental health status is. That you don't want to do that.
Yeah, please don't do that. Keep your job. Don't get fired.
Well, don't get sued, right?
Like, and don't violate people's rights. Another strategy that is along the lines of inclusion is creating an inclusive recruiting and talent selection process. And I'll share two of my favorite strategies. And this may sound like utopia, but I promise you it is possible, because I've done it and I've seen it done. One, have a panel of people, not just AI, a panel of people who review resumes and participate in the interview process, so that there is the opportunity to gently call out when there's evidence of biased behavior. And that can be done respectfully and with gentleness. And it's happened to me before. I was on an interview panel, and we were having some dialogue talking about how to evaluate, how to prepare for the entire process. And someone called out and said, "Hey, this entire panel is women." I thought, oh, you know what? we need to bring along some guys into this interview panel. Why? Because our lived experiences gives each of us a different lens through which to evaluate. And the more people, not so many people, but the more people we have with different experiences, different approaches, it allows evaluating resumes and evaluating candidates from different lenses, checking each other's biases, and also increasing the chances that you're actually hiring the best person for the job.
Again, three thoughts there. I absolutely totally agree with you. I'm just trying to think through the lens of someone that's looking for a job now, going back to tying this conversation back to the job seekers, right? I hope we've made one thing clear. This process is difficult for people on both sides, for the job seeker and for the hiring manager and those poor recruiters that are in the middle of it all. It's hard on everybody. Maybe that's something as a job seeker that you should look for in a company. Like if you have ADHD or neurodivergence and the job selection process is that stressful, imagine what their work environment is going to be like. Imagine how hard it would be to actually live through that 8 hours a day for 5 days a week for the rest of your time with that company. So you should be as picky about them as they're trying to be about you. Make sure that it's a right fit both ways.
It is a two-way process, right? That said, you know, this, like I said, it's almost 7 million people out there are looking for jobs. And some may feel like they're not in a position to be picky. And they might feel like, hey, you know what? This may not be a place where I'd love to work, but I need a job right now. I might offer for someone in that situation, first, you're making a really difficult choice. You're making a trade-off and evaluating and potentially making a trade-off between working at a place that is not ideal, but doing so because you have a need to meet. That's very, very real. That said, it is an opportunity, like you said, Andrew, for someone to evaluate the place of work. And if you're selected and you choose to work somewhere that doesn't seem as open or accommodating, being aware of what you're walking into so that you can create strategies that will help you be able to adapt in that situation until either the circumstances change or you're able to change the circumstances.
Yeah.
But I could continue to go back to that. In the potential employee relationship, the employer is the one in the position of power. And in my opinion, has the biggest responsibility here to do something to make a change because they have the most power and the least risk at stake.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to make a quick disclaimer. We're not making a suggestion that you disclose your diagnosis in the job selection process. I just want to be very clear about that. What we're saying is challenge yourself to consider that as an option and weigh it as an option and make the best choice for yourself. I just want to be super clear that we're not saying go out there and tell everybody you have ADHD. Like when Flo first mentioned this, we don't have our cameras on, but I almost fell out of my office chair because, again, my gut was like, oh, heck no, I'm not telling anybody. I'm not exposing my difference. But she makes a lot of compelling points.
Maybe. And it depends on the place of work. I worked with someone recently who specifically selects organizations that they know will be not only accommodating, but supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, it might make sense for the individual to disclose. It's important to read not just what's on the website, but really research the organizational culture. For example, Glassdoor I have a love-hate relationship with it because most people are going to contribute to content on Glassdoor when they're not happy. And when people are happy, they're less likely to contribute. Just like if I have a terrible experience at the store, I'm more likely to complain about it than I am to tell everybody how great the experience might be somewhere else, right?
Yep.
But do your research. Connect with people, you know, asynchronously on LinkedIn or other platforms with people who work in that organization and try to get a feel for what they're really like, not just what their values and mission and vision or whatever it is that they have on their website, but to see what it might actually feel like to work in that organization. In your research, also look at where has that organization spent their money? What are they contributing to? What kind of or other organizations are they aligning themselves with? And that might give you an idea of the consistency between the stated culture and what the culture actually is. So that becomes information to help you decide when, if at all, to disclose neurodivergence or whether to hang back and keep it to yourself and find other ways to adapt. But it is important to protect. There's always risk, but it is we do encourage everyone to protect their safety and for the people in positions of power to make it safe.
Yeah. And, you know, you hit on the topic of corporate social responsibility and beyond just Glassdoor itself. Another great place you can find a company's stance on social responsibility is their own website. Usually they'll have an about us or very deep down in investor relations. Something about where they're spending their charitable dollars that they, you know, or what programs they support. So that's a very great place to look for how a company actually supports all stakeholders, because corporate social responsibility, and when I say that, what that is a company, and how do they support the community around them, not necessarily their shareholders or their employees, but the communities in which they operate or organizations, nonprofits they might support. It's all of that. Right. So are they a conscientious company?
And that is very, very telling. Wow. We covered a lot today. And of course, this needed to be a two-part episode because there was so much to explore. And as we got into what it might be like for someone to be moving in this job market, and in addition to that, being neurodivergent and the differences with approaching the interview process, engaging with HR. We also covered how important it is to choose wisely whether to disclose your neurodivergence in the process. And then also for organizations and hiring leaders, what they can do to make it so that the person who is neurodivergent has a fair shot in the selection process and that they're able to select the best of the best, not just the best of neurotypical candidates. As we wrap up this episode of Different at Work, we want to thank you for joining us, and we hope that you keep being you, different at work.
Hi, one final note. We are not mental health professionals, and nothing you hear on this podcast is meant to replace therapy, diagnosis, or professional care. We are just two people sharing what we've lived and learned. If today's episode brought something up for you, or you're just looking for support, visit our website at differentatwork.com for additional resources. Again, that's differentatwork.com. Just click the resources tab. Goodbye.